offering a most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Shravanam Mananam Nididhyasanam. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Hari from the Shri Satya Sai Central Trust. For those of you who are following us regularly, this is the 11th discourse in the 1991 summer course series that we're going through in the past couple of weeks. This discourse was delivered on 31st of May, and it's primarily on the various forms of God, but I think that would be saying too little about what this discourse is about. But before going into what Swami has been speaking in this discourse, because I think we've come a little far from that initial core concept that Swami was speaking about, so before we probably go into what Swami is saying in this week's episode, we'll give you a short overview of how the entire discourse is structured. But before all of that, let's invite Brother Hari to join all of us. Saram Hari.
Saram Prem.
As I was thinking, I was just going through the discourse many times, especially on this program. I think we take a long time to come to the middle of the discourse. We might forget where the whole structure starts from.
The thread, right.
So I was just going back. It's so very beautifully, Swami is very, very, in a very sequential form, Swami is coming to the thing. Mm-hmm. For in fact, Swami starts off by speaking about Brahmanandam. Hmm. That's completely lost in the whole thing. Hmm. Swami started off by speaking of Brahmanandam, and the ability to reach that is within every human being.
Yes.
And then Swami said that it's a composite word which has Brahman and Anandam. So you cannot have that bliss without having access to God, going to Brahman. And then of course there was a short paragraph of Swami saying that even in this relationship between God, how you need to progress from one stage to the other. Where Swami said that the whole idea that you're not able to see the Brahman is because you're afflicted from attachment, fear, anger, and these qualities. But Swami said, just going beyond these qualities will not give you that bliss. Swami said, from there, bliss can be drawn with the renouncing attachment, fear, and anger is not sufficient. Love for God must be cultivated as well. Mm-hmm. So Swami said, it's not enough if you just become a detached person, but there should be love for God. And then Swami said, even love for God is not enough, because God's love for you, remembering that God's love is there for you, is important.
Yes, yes.
And then Swami said, even that is not enough. The next stage is when you have complete reliance on God. Mm. That's when the surrender aspect comes. And then Swami said, that is how you go closer to God. And then Swami said, one of the ways is to understand what God is. To understand this nature of God is an important process in all of this. And that's when Swami started speaking about the three forms. And a very important connecting line Swami said is, because the whole thing is about understanding the relationship between the creation and the creator. Mm-hmm. How there is, when we say that God has created man in the image of himself, mm-hmm. it is not necessarily that physical form. Mm-hmm. And I think when we think of it as a physical form, then we start worshipping forms of humans which have become superhuman, and we treat them like God, mm-hmm. with four limbs and three heads or whatever it is. But when Swami says that man has been created in the image of God, what actually it is these three states of the gross, the subtle, and the causal, and the waking, the dream, and the deep sleep. And that's what the rest of the discourse was about, where Swami is talking about the three aspects of divinity, Virata, Hiranyagarbha, and Avyakrita, how it is related to the waking state, the dream state, and the deep sleep state. Then Swami went on to speak about in what way the dream is different from the waking stage. Mm-hmm. I think that is the point where Swami came to the concept of the four qualities which define reality, right, in the sense of time, task, cause, and duty. Mm. Kala, karma, karana, and kartavya. Mm. That's what Swami said. And of course, in the past couple of weeks, we've been talking about how, however high you are in your intellectual understanding, you cannot, you've not outgrown these four qualities. And that's how Swami himself embodied it. And Swami ensured that all of us, even though we could drift away in the name of spirituality many times, Swami ensured that we were anchored to all of these. And from there, Swami went on. Last week, the clip which we played was about the Adi Bhautikam, Adi Atmikam, and the Adi Daivikam, where he said that how much ever you might plan, how much ever you might think that everything is under control, there is much of it which happens which is beyond you. and much of it which happens within you, which is not in, under your control. And Swami said all of that comes under Adi Daivikam, which is a mysterious force which does what has to be done even without your volition or willing it. And then Swami spoke of how that is different from Adhyatmikam and Adi Daivikam. I think that's where we were when we were speaking last time. And of course that discussion drifted on to the idea of the sun principle and the moon principle and how it's related to what is within the human experience.
Yes, because the Upanishad, the Mandukya Upanishad, which is primarily what is being covered in these discourses, earlier itself the Mandukya Upanishad has equated the physical person with the cosmic person.
Right.
So there is mention of how the, you know, the earlier verses of the Mandukya Upanishad speaks about how the cosmic person known as the Virat Swarupa has and in the physical plane, it is the sun that represents the higher regions and the, you know, moon, the eyes and the
Dakshinayana and Uttarayana.
Yeah. So that is the physical structure of the cosmic person. And again, Swami is bringing up that when we speak of the, when we say, when we look at the verse, like say, Chakshos Suryo Ajayata, Chandrama Manaso Jataha, Chakshos Suryo Ajayata, we do not, you know, try to parse this sentence by saying that how can the, you know, eyes be the sun or how can the mind be the moon. And Swami is saying very clearly that these are not meant to be taken like literally. They have to be understood as the unifying principle between, say, the mind and the moon, for example. Like how the mind transitions through various phases, right? Waxes and wanes. That same stages are undergone by the moon. So that is the, at least at the surface understanding, like that is the moon principle at work.
Right.
So Swami is saying like, these are not to be made just of when you take them literally and then try to, you know, like show it as a ridiculous sentence.
And of course, going back a little bit in what Swami was saying last week, I mean, in that same concept of karma and all of that, I recollected we were speaking about this in the previous afternoon satsang program, where when Swami was having a question-answer session with some of the medical representatives in Uganda, when Swami was visiting there, one of the questions which were posed to Swami was this. He said, Swami, is action so important? Because even texts like Bhagavad Gita glorify devotion and jnana more. So, does, is karma important at all? So, the answer which Swami gave was, I mean, absolutely, what do you mean? It's all about karma, right? Gita is all about karma. And Swami said, the progression is always that way. Karma, bhakti, leading on to jnana. So, if that doesn't happen, then, you know, if anything missing in between is, it's an incomplete experience. You cannot claim. So of course, that was the whole thing that Swami was going on speaking about karma. And from that karma, as Swami was going, that that karma which happens absolutely involuntarily is in fact a spark of divinity within you. And from there, of course, that Chandrama and the sun, the comparisons between the whole thing. Was that the last concept Swami spoke about?
Yes, so that is where we were in the, like towards the end of that discourse or that segment.
Swami was telling that the ability to see comes from the eye.
Yes.
Yeah, I think Swami spoke about it when he was talking about how the sages of the past were able to come to these conclusions and how we dismiss it as, you know, quite, I mean, not logical or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Swami was saying how it all does fall in place.
Yes.
Should we go to the clip and then
yes,
discuss
I
about
think,
it?
Yeah, we can continue.
ఈ సూర్యులకు ఈ నేత్రములకు ఉండేటువంటి సంబంధం ఏమిటి?
What sort of relationship is present between the sun and the eye?
ఏకత్వం అనగా నెగటివ్ పాజిటివ్ చేరినట్టుగా.
In this unity, just as there is negative and positive,
అప్పుడు ఈ దృశ్యమైనటువంటి యొక్క దీనినంతా కూడా నువ్వు చూడగలుగుతున్నాడు.
Then only he will be able to see the different scenes.
ఒట్టి నెగిటివ్ ఉంటే దాంట్లో ఏ విధమైన ఫలితము మనకు లభించదు.
When there is only negative,
ఒట్టి పాజిటివ్ ఉంటే దాంట్లో మనకు ఏ విధమైన ఫలితము లభించదు.
With only positive, you cannot have any result.
ఒక చేరిక జరగాలి.
There should be the joining of these.
కన్నులు ఉన్నాయి కదా అని.
Because you have eyes.
మనం చీకటింటిలో పోయి కన్నులు తెరుచుకుంటే ఏ పదార్థము కనిపించదు.
When you open your eyes in darkness, you cannot see any matter.
పోనీ లైట్ ఉన్నది కదా అని కన్నులు మూసుకుంటే ఏ పదార్థము కనిపించదు.
బికాస్ దేర్ ఇస్ లైట్, వెన్ యూ క్లోజ్ యువర్ ఐస్ యూ కెనాట్ సీ ఎనీ ఆబ్జెక్ట్.
ఆ లైట్ ఈ కన్నుల యొక్క దృష్టి రెండూ చేరాలి.
Therefore, the light outside and the eyes should join.
ఈ రెండింటి యొక్క చేరిక చేతనే పదార్థం యొక్క స్వరూపాన్ని మనం నిరూపిస్తున్నాం.
When both of them join, then only you can prove the nature of the matter.
సూర్య కాంతి, నేత్ర కాంతి, రెండింటి యొక్క చేరికనే జగత్ సృష్టి.
The light of the sun, the light of the eye join, and that is responsible for the creation of the world.
The entire kudanu ekkada nunchi manaku kanipistundadi, drishti nunchi kanipistundadi.
The entire creation you visualize out of vision.
Drishtiye lekapothe srushtiye ledu.
When there is no vision, there is no creation.
కనుకని దృష్టి అత్యవసరమైనటువంటిది.
దేర్ ఫోర్ విజన్ ఇస్ మోస్ట్ ఇంపార్టెంట్.
దృష్టిలో ఎట్టి దోషములు లేవు.
దేర్ ఇస్ నో డిఫెక్ట్ ఇన్ క్రియేషన్.
అంతా దృష్టిలోనే ఉంటుండాలి.
ద డిఫెక్ట్ లైస్ ఇన్ విజన్.
కనుక దృష్టిని మనము పవిత్రమైన దృష్టిగా మనం ఏర్పరచుకోవాలి.
దేర్ ఫోర్ వీ షుడ్ మేక్ అవర్ విజన్ సీక్రెట్.
దీనిని ఉపనిషత్తులు చక్కగా బోధిస్తూ వచ్చాయి.
దిస్ ఈస్ థాట్ వెల్ ఇన్ ఉపనిషత్స్.
నేత్రములే నీ శాస్త్రములు.
The eyes are your shastra.
నీ దృష్టియ ఈ సృష్టి.
Your vision is creation.
ఈ రెండింటికి నీకు సంబంధ బాంధవ్యాన్ని నీవు పెంచుకోమని బోధిస్తున్నాయి.
You develop the feeling of the interrelationships between these two.
కనుక ఏ యొక్క భౌతిక శాస్త్రమునందు కూడాను మనం తెలుసుకోలే విషయాలను ఉపనిషత్తుల ద్వారా మనం ఎంతనో తెలుసుకోగలుగుతున్నాం.
సో మెనీ అదర్ థింగ్స్ విచ్ వీ కుడ్ నాట్ అండర్స్టాండ్ త్రూ సైన్స్ కుడ్ బి వెల్ అండర్స్టూడ్ త్రూ ఉపనిషత్స్.
ఈనాడు సైన్స్ తెలుసుకున్నటువంటిది చాలా తక్కువ.
టుడే వాట్ సైన్స్ హెస్ డిస్కవర్డ్ ఈస్ వెరీ లిటిల్.
కానీ అణుమాత్రమైనటువంటి జ్ఞానాన్ని తెలుసుకుని
హ్యావింగ్ అండర్స్టూడ్ ఎ ఫ్రాక్షన్
అనంతం తెలుసుకున్నామని అహంకార పడిపోతున్నారు ఈనాటి మానవులు.
బ్లోట్స్ అప్ విత్ ఈగో హ్యావింగ్ అండర్స్టూడ్ ఎవ్రీథింగ్.
కానీ అణువులోనే ఘనం ఉంటుందని బోధిస్తుందని ఆధ్యాత్మికము.
But spirituality teaches that there is macrocosm and microcosm.
మహతో మహీయాం. అణువులో అణువుగా, మహత్తులో మహత్తుగా ఉంటుండాలి.
హీఈస్ ఎన్ ఆటమ్ ఇన్ ఆటమ్ అండ్ బిగ్గెస్ట్ అమాంగ్ ద బిగ్.
చిన్న విత్తనమును భూమిలో పెట్టి నాటినప్పుడు
వెన్ ఎ స్మాల్ సీడ్ ఈస్ సోన్ ఇన్ ద సాయిల్
ఇది మహా పెద్ద మర్రి వృక్షంగా తయారైపోతుండాలి.
ఇట్ గ్రోస్ ఇన్ టు జైజాంటిక్ బనియన్ ట్రీ.
ఇంత పెద్ద వృక్షం ఎక్కడి నుంచి వచ్చింది?
వేర్ ఫ్రమ్ దిస్ జైజాంటిక్ ట్రీ?
చిన్న విత్తనం నుంచినే వచ్చింది.
ఇట్ జర్మినేటెడ్ అవుట్ ఆఫ్ ద
స్మాల్ సీడ్. విత్తనంలోనే కొమ్మలు, రెమ్మలు, కాయలు, ఆకులు, పువ్వులు అన్ని అందులోనే ఇమిడి ఉంటున్నాయి.
ద బ్రాంచెస్, ద లీవ్స్, ద ఫ్రూట్స్, ఫ్లవర్స్ ఆర్ కంటైన్డ్ ఇన్ దట్ స్మాల్ సీడ్.
అయితే ఎప్పుడు అవి బయటకు ఆవిర్భవిస్తున్నాయి?
But when do they come out?
ఈ విత్తనము తన ఆకారాన్ని శిథిలముగా ఉంచుకున్నప్పుడే ఆ వృక్షం బయట పడుతున్నాయి.
When once the seed loses its shape, then only these things come out.
భూమిలో విత్తనము నాటినప్పుడు
when you sow the seed in the ground,
తన రూపాన్ని తాను భిన్నం చేసుకుంటుంది.
It destroys its own form.
అనగా అహంకారాన్ని విసర్జిస్తుంది.
It sacrifices ego.
తన ఆకారాన్ని విసర్జిస్తుంది.
ఇట్ లూజెస్ ఇట్స్ ఫామ్.
అప్పుడే నూతనమైన ఆకారాన్ని ధరిస్తుంది.
దెన్ ఓన్లీ ఇట్ విల్ హ్యావ్ న్యూ ఫామ్.
తన ఆకారం ఆకారంగానే ఉంటుంటే నూతన ఆకారమైనటువంటి యొక్క అనంతత్వము ఇందులో ఏమాత్రం మనకు అర్థం కాదు.
ఇఫ్ ఇట్ రిమైన్స్ ఇన్ ఇట్స్ ఒరిజినల్ ఫామ్, యూ కెనాట్ అండర్స్టాండ్.
వృక్షం అందుకోను
ఇన్ దిస్ లార్జ్ హ్యూజ్ ట్రీ
అణుమాత్రమైనటువంటి విత్తనం ఉంటుండాలి.
దేర్ ఇస్ అ వెరీ స్మాల్ మైన్యూట్ సీడ్ దేర్.
కనుక అణోరణీయాన్ మహతో మహీయాన్.
Therefore, out of microcosm,
అణువు నుంచి అణువు వస్తుండాలి.
From atom, the infinite has come. Out of infinite, the atom has come.
కనుక ఈ అనంతము అణువు రెండింటి యొక్క విభాగం మనం విచారణ చేసినప్పుడు రెండు ఒక్కటే.
Therefore, when we enquire, the atom and infinity,
దాని వికారం ఇది, దీని ఆకారం అది.
This is one, the other one is its shape.
ఆకార వికారముల యొక్క భేదమే దీనికి ప్రమాణం కాని పదార్థం ఒక్కటే.
ఇట్ ఇస్ ద షేప్ అండ్ అదర్ ఫామ్, యాక్చువల్లీ ది మ్యాటర్ ఇస్ వన్.
ఇది ఉపనిషత్తుల యొక్క ప్రధానమైనటువంటి యొక్క రహస్యము.
దిస్ ది మెయిన్ సీక్రెట్ ఇన్ ఉపనిషత్.
ఒక్కొక్క ఉపనిషత్తు కూడాను
ఈచ్ ఉపనిషత్
సృష్టి యొక్క రహస్యాన్ని,
ద సీక్రెట్స్ ఆఫ్ క్రియేషన్,
చక్కగా విపులము చేస్తూ వచ్చింది.
క్లియర్లీ ఎక్స్ప్లెయిన్డ్ ది సీక్రెట్ ఆఫ్ క్రియేషన్.
అర్థం చేసుకునేటువంటి వారు ఒక్కొక్కరు వారి వారి తెలివితేటలను పురస్కరించుకుని, మేధాశక్తిని పురస్కరించుకుని అర్థం చేసుకుంటూ వచ్చారు.
ఈచ్ వన్ బేసింగ్ ఆన్ హిజ్ ఓన్ కెపాసిటీ, ది మెంటల్ కెపాసిటీ, స్టార్టెడ్ అండర్స్టాండింగ్ ఇన్ హిజ్ ఓన్ వే.
అది వారి ప్రాకృతమైనటువంటి యొక్క ప్రాక్టీస్, అభ్యాసములు పురస్కరించుకుని వస్తుంటారు.
ఇట్స్ ఆల్ బేస్డ్ ఆన్ దర్ ఫిజికల్ ప్రాక్టీస్.
ఇది ప్రాకృతమైనటువంటి వికారములు.
This is worldly vikar or perversity.
Oka mamsahari oka adavilo poi chettu pai unna pakshini chuchinappudu danni chustadu, aha దీనిని ఈనాడు కొట్టితే నా ఇంటిలో అందరు కూడా భుజించవచ్చును అని దాని యొక్క మాంసము మాత్రమే దృష్టి ఎందుకుంటాడు.
ద వన్ హూ రిలీజియస్ నాన్ వెజిటేరియన్ ఫుడ్ వెన్ యూ లుక్స్ ఎట్ ఎ బర్డ్ ఇఫ్ ఐ హిట్ ఇట్ ఐ కెన్ ఎంజాయ్ ది ఫ్లెష్ ఆఫ్ ఇట్ ద హోల్ ఫ్యామిలీ విల్ బి హ్యాపీ.
ఒక కవియే దానిని చూచినప్పుడు ఆహా దీని యొక్క రంగులు ఎంత స్థితిగా ఉన్నాయి, దీని యొక్క ఈకలు ఎంత పవిత్రంగా ఉంటున్నాయి, ఎంత సాఫ్ట్ గా ఉంటున్నాయి అని దానిని చక్కగా వర్ణిస్తూ వస్తాడు.
When a poet looks at the bird, he starts looking at the different colors and
పదార్థం ఒక్కటే అయినప్పటికీ ఒక్కొక్కరి దృష్టి ఒక్కొక్క రీతిగా ఉంటుంటాది.
Though the matter is one, each one will have his own understanding.
అదే విధముగానే ఈ దృష్టి యొక్క దోషం ఎక్కడి నుంచి ప్రారంభమైంది?
When the mistake in the vision
started. మన అభ్యాసం నుంచి ప్రారంభమైంది.
It is out of this worldly practice the mistake started.
కనుక మంచిది కూడాను అభ్యాసం ద్వారానే మనం పెంచుకోవాలి.
So you should develop good out of practice.
కనుక నే శ్రేయో హి జ్ఞానం అభ్యాసాత్ జ్ఞానాధ్యానం విశిష్యతే ధ్యానాత్ కర్మ ఫలత్యాగ త్యాగశాంతి అనంతరం. ప్రతి దానికి కూడా అభ్యాసం అత్యవసరము.
For everything practice is very important.
పుట్టిన బిడ్డ నడచవాలంటే అభ్యాసం చేయాలి.
For the child to walk, the child should practice.
పుట్టిన బిడ్డ కొంతకాలమైన తర్వాత భుజించాలంటే అభ్యాసం చేయాలి.
For the child to part a foot should start practice.
పుట్టిన బిడ్డ మాట్లాడాలంటే అభ్యాసం చేయాలి.
For the child to speak should practice.
ఇవన్నీ వాకింగ్ టాకింగ్ రీడింగ్ రైటింగ్ ఈటింగ్ అన్ని కూడా అభ్యాసం చేతనే వచ్చినటువంటివి.
వాకింగ్ టాకింగ్ ఈటింగ్ ఎవ్రీథింగ్ కమ్స్ అవుట్ ఆఫ్ ప్రాక్టీస్.
కానీ అభ్యాసం లేకుండా ఏదాన్ని కూడా మనం సాధించలేము.
వితౌట్ ప్రాక్టీస్ వీ కెనాట్ అకంప్లిష్ ఎనీథింగ్.
కనుకనే ఈ యొక్క ఉపనిషత్తుల విషయాన్ని కూడా అభ్యాస రూపంలో మనం అనుసరించినప్పుడే దీని యొక్క పవిత్రమైన స్వరూపాన్ని మనం సందర్శించగలము.
వీ కెన్ హ్యావ్ ద సీక్రెట్ ఫామ్ కంటైన్డ్ ఇన్ ది ఉపనిషత్స్ అవుట్ ఆఫ్ ప్రాక్టీస్.
బ్రహ్మానందం అనగా
స్వామి వెన్ స్వామి ఇస్ టెలింగ్ వాట్ ఇస్ బ్రహ్మానందం విల్ హావ్ టు వెయిట్ ఫర్ వైల్ ఫర్ దాట్ బట్ ఆఫ్ కోర్స్ I think usually every discourse has this, right? You know, after a certain time, the practical side of the discourse starts, where Swami starts telling what you can start doing. And very, very mundane examples and analogies Swami gives to explain that. So it's a continuation of the sun and the moon from last week. But in this one, Swami is talking about how the physical and the subtle is important in the form of the negative and the positive to be able to see everything. And you don't dismiss completely what is seen by the physical eye, but don't go by everything that the physical eye tells you to.
Right. Because what Swami, this is a continuation of what we were in the closing segment of last time. We were discussing how Swami is making the point that it is the sun, it is by the power of the sun that we are able to perceive the entire creation. At the same time, the Upanishads also tell us that, you know, the chaksho surya jayata, so the eyes themselves have come from the sun itself. So the, you know, the element of fire, that is what animates, you know, the ability of the eye to see.
Right.
So in continuing from there, so Swami is saying that this is the kind of relation that exists between the sun and the eyes. Like, so one is like the positive and the other is the negative. But I think the most important point that Swami was making in this is that the creation, Srishti, has emerged from your drishti. In the sense that whatever vision, see, Swami says that there is no defect as such in creation except for what you see. And that doesn't mean like what you perceive with the physical eye, but rather what you interpret about what you see. Right? And that is a very important point that Swami used to make this point several times. Like he used to say, Srishti lo emi lopam ledu, mi drishti lone lopam unnadi. There's no defect in Srishti itself.
Right.
But the drishti is what you need. And that's a very mature, you know, lesson for all of us to learn. Like, because even at a mundane level, many of the conflicts that we see with people around us are because we hold on to one point of view that we generate. And Swami always the you know, balm for all that is to say that may not be the truth. Right? It's just
benefit
one
doubt.
Sorry? Yeah, the
give
benefit
the person
of doubt,
the benefit of doubt. Yeah.
Because this is just your interpretation based on what you have seen, and that's a very limited and if you can drop that, then many of the conflicts that we have, they tend to get dropped. And in many different ways, Swami used to illustrate the same thing. The other way, Swami used to say, give the example of that prince, no, who wanted to walk into the forest.
Mm-hmm.
And in the forest there are several thorns. So he would give the order that, you know, I want the entire forest area to be carpeted. And then the minister says, very simple solution, instead of spending so much money and effort, how about you wear a pair of slippers?
Mm.
Or in other ways, Swami used to say that, illustrate by saying that when you wear a red glass, the entire world looks red. You wear green, the entire world looks green.
Mm.
So as such, the world has not changed, but the filter through which you are looking at the world, that has changed. Of course, the same point Swami goes on to develop in a different way.
Right. When Swami is speaking about this, it all lies in the way you look at it. Swami made a point. He said even meaning comes from how you look at it.
Yeah.
I recall we used to have a maths teacher in school, and he was very, very fond of maths. So though he was teaching us in school, in the evening he used to teach in a university for higher level mathematics, because he just loved the subject, and he would fill his day with it, right? So sometimes he would come and write an equation on the board, some proof or something like that. And you know how maths is, you know, it fills the whole board. And if you have not followed the subject, you have no idea what's there on the board. But we would see that, you know, he would fill the board with all of those equations. They would, he would step back and he would admire it, like how you would probably see a Da Vinci, or, you know, you would see a painting which is so very enthralling to look at. He would literally see that. We could make out nothing of the equation, but we would be so inspired by the way he was, you know, treating that thing. And you'd say, it's so beautiful. I mean, are you able to see what I'm seeing? He would say that it's so beautiful. You know, what a wonderful proof it is. And, you know, what beauty is there in that. And every time I remember that scene, that's the same thing, you know, in that blackboard. For people like me, there was chaos. You know, there was utter confusion. But he was seeing probably art in that, you know, confusion. And that's what Swami says, you know, when you, the way you look at it, and that changes with your perspective. The way your thinking changes, the way you look at the world also changes.
Exactly.
Right?
And a lot of it is dictated by, like, our concept of who we are.
Right.
You know, like, you remember once we had this conversation, like, you know, you seat Sherlock Holmes and Watson at the same table, and a guest comes in. So what Watson sees is completely different from what Sherlock Holmes sees.
Right.
Because Watson looks at the person, say, from the point of view of that he's... So Watson is an army man.
Mm.
Sherlock Holmes is a detective. And what he looks for in that person is completely colored by his perception of who he is.
Right.
So for Sherlock Holmes, he is a detective. And we, for example, we talk about personality. So we look at a teacher. Mm. We say that the teacher or a principal is a principal everywhere. No, you know, it's not just in the school. They go home, they still remain a principal. They go to a, you know, family function, even there, they are a principal. And they kind of stand out, you know, like a judge or a lawyer. Whoever it is, your profession walks around with you. And that profession is your concept of who you are. And because of that, you begin to see the world differently. A chartered accountant would see a balance sheet and recognize something that, you know, you and I may not be able to. Because that's because he is a chartered accountant, right? And he carries that around. So no matter what he sees, you talk to him about your investments, like, he'll immediately have a view on that. Right? So that is how the view of whatever you see is, it depends a lot on your conception of who you are.
Right. And I think that's why I was interested with that beginning which Swami had. And Swami was speaking about Brahmanandam. The next thing which Swami said was that Brahmanandam will only come with knowledge of the Brahman or Brahma Vidya. And then Swami said, you know, don't be scared. Everybody is capable of having Brahma Vidya.
Yeah.
And that's how the discourse starts.
Yeah.
I recall what Swami would tell one very beautiful Telugu poem. He would say, Ihamuna Sukimpa Hema Taraka Vidya, Paramuna Sukimpa Brahma Vidya. So you'd say all the knowledge that you fill in your mind, what we call the secular knowledge, your learning, your education, it will give you the ability to gather that happiness which you can enjoy now. And, you know, tomorrow if you want it again, you need to repeat the same process again.
Right.
Or if it's not a daily basis, it's probably over a period of time. But you need to exercise that ability every now and then to enjoy that happiness. Now Swami would say that this Brahma Vidya, the moment your mind is filled with Brahma Vidya, you get that happiness which is eternal. Right? It's the same mind. You're just preconditioning, I mean, you're just removing the precondition of the mind and making your mind see more than what it just sees. And that's the whole thing. When Swami says that you see the meaning, when you see the meaning, you cease to see the chaos.
Right.
You know, it ceases to trouble you. And the classic example that Swami would give is that of somebody like Gautama Buddha. Right? You know, he goes out into the world, he says, I need to find a solution for all of these problems. I need to find a solution for death, for ill health, for old age. He comes back without the ability to do anything about any of these things. But he's just come in a state where everything is perfect as it is. Right? So he has come to a state where he doesn't have to change anything. He has just come to a state where he sees the harmony in all the confusion which he saw before.
That's right.
Right.
So that's a very beautiful concept which you just mentioned, right? So that, in fact, Swami gives these so many different ways of dealing with our the situations that we we encounter in our daily lives. And at the first stage, like Swami says that, you know, this too shall pass.
Right.
Right. So any situation that comes our way, instead of getting very disturbed, we just say so Swami is to say that even in the Pandavas, Yudhishthira would keep repeating that this too shall pass, you know, this too shall pass. So that is like one level of coping with a tough situation. And then the second situation, again Swami changes the context of what sorrow is or what difficulties are. And he says the next level is to actually trust the Lord and say that
whatever happens,
comes is good for me.
Mm.
You know, so that is a more positive, engaged with that situation now, totally embracing the situation now. And as you rightly said, now the situation is very perfect because it's now given as God's prasadam himself. So now, you know, what are the lessons that we can learn from that situation, right? So those, it just triggered off when he said, you know.
Right, that, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the beauty of Swami's message. This is the theory part of it. You know, this is how it works. But Swami finally gives us that takeaway, you know, things. Something like, as you were saying, this too shall pass or, you know, whatever happens is good for me. We probably might not be able to comprehend it completely, you know. Many times when you're really in the thick of a sticky situation, you don't know how it will pass. Right? You don't know. I mean, especially people who are in financial issues and all that. You don't know. Every morning you'll have to wake up to the same issue.
Right.
You don't know when that period will pass, how it will really pass.
Right.
And Swami says, no, just keep this in your mind that this too shall pass. Nothing stays. And that classic enactment of the Mahabharata episode, which you were referring to, it was so beautiful where, you know, I still remember the way Swami had directed that particular scene where everybody is fretting and fuming about what has happened and they've lost everything and all that. And then Krishna comes and gives this in a piece of leaf where he says, this too shall pass. Then each one narrates, you know, what about the, loss that we have faced. And Yudhishthira reads out, this too shall pass. And what about the infamy which you're facing? What about the anger from our family members we're facing? And for each one of those things, he says, this too shall pass. So however improbable it looks that it will pass, Swami says, just keep it in mind that this too shall pass. You'll at least have the equanimity which is necessary to deal with the situation.
Exactly. Right? So coming to that, you know, that equanimity for Swami was the biggest thing.
Right.
At the culmination of every spiritual effort, as far as Swami is concerned, the physical plane was to grant equanimity. You know? So the highest the highest form of devotion essentially for Bhagwan was that the person gains equanimity at the end of it. Right.
Right.
And that is why, there's that very famous story, right, Zen story. So it's said that there is this farmer. And he has horses, you know, that as part of his property. And one fine day when he wakes up in the morning, he sees that the horses have bolted from the stable.
Okay.
And all his neighbors, they come to commiserate with him.
Right.
And then, while they're all saying, we're so sorry that, you know,
you lost your horse.
Best horses they have left. I mean, you don't have them anymore. He says, we'll see. You know, that's all he says. So then after a couple of days, those horses which left, they have come back now with, they have gained some friend horses and brought them all back. So now the villagers, they come, they congregate, they all celebrate saying that now you have more horses than you had before.
You're
he
so
says,
lucky.
We'll see. Then again, after a couple of days, his young son is trying to tame the new horses, the wild horses. So he's riding them and one of them throws his son off the back. So he falls and fractures his leg. So again, the villagers, neighbors, they all come, you know, they share his sorrow. But he says, we'll see. Then a couple of days later, the kingdom goes to war and they're looking for young people to draft into the army. So they come knocking at the farmer's door. And then they, you know, the young, his young son, they cannot draft him into the army because his leg is fractured, he's disabled now. And, you know, the villagers come and say, wow, look at your luck. He says, we'll see. So at every stage, like in this story, we'll see that the situation as it is, the farmer has evaluated it is like perfect in the moment. You know, it's totally all right in the moment.
Right.
And it is true, you know, no matter how drastic the situation looks. Right?
Right. Yeah, most often, you know, that's what you need, the ability to step back and say, at least let me wait, you know, let me not react. As we often would say, don't make decisions when you're either excited or you're depressed. Don't make promises, especially when you're happy. Right?
Or don't say anything.
So from there, Swami goes on to this concept about the Upanishads, you know, how they have a more comprehensive and enhanced view of things, which sometimes seems to be lacking in science. Swami was saying, that is the point Swami was making here, that scientific knowledge in comparison to the Upanishadic wisdom is very, very infinitely small. Right? And then Swami, I mean, this phrase of Anuraniyan, Mahato Mahiyan, Swami usually uses it in the concept, in the description of God, that He is smaller than the smallest and He is larger than the largest. But in this case, I think a very beautiful diversion from that. Swami is using it in a very beautiful context. Right?
In fact, in some other context, Swami was explaining like how the word Vishnu, right? So the Vishnu itself relates to the mind.
Right.
Right. And so Swami was explaining how Vishnu is supposed to reside where? In Vaikuntha. And Swami asked, like, what is the meaning of this word Vaikuntha? And then Swami explained that actually Vaikuntha means like very, 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 very broad. You know, it can contain everything in itself. So that is the meaning. So it's also very consistent, because I was just thinking this, Anuraniyan Mahato Mahiyan, it appears in the Mahanarayana Upanishad.
Okay.
And there Vishnu stands for, therefore, the vast, you know, the boundless and the vastness, which is precisely this. So Vishnu on the one hand is creation and therefore is present in like every single atom of this universe. So, and at the same time, he is the entire expanse of the universe. So that phrase Anuraniyan Mahato Mahiyan, it captures the, you know, entire spectrum of whatever is possible for divinity.
Right. And in this example that Swami was giving about a seed that becomes a tree, there Swami was saying that the entire tree is contained in the seed and the tree eventually contains the seed.
Right? Yes.
And Swami was saying that that is what is Anuraniyan Mahato Mahiyan, where the infinite is contained in the limited or the small, and the same small which is literally like that seed, figuratively and literally, is again contained in the infinite.
Yes.
And that's how they're connected to each other.
And the way so beautifully Swami brings out, you know, like I just seeing, we look at, say, an individual person's spiritual development, right? And Swami says that when the seed has to become a tree, like it has to give up its own ego, right? It has to break itself up so that existence as a seed, which could have like gone on endlessly, right? But it has to give up that desire to remain as a seed for long and allow itself. The moment you let go of that need to remain a seed, at that moment it's possible now that you grow into a tree. And the interesting thing is that Swami very nicely says, when the seed loses its shape and form, its grander qualities come into existence. So now you become a tree and like, you know, you're able to bear fruits, you're able to be more useful to society, people come and enjoy your shade, and so many, you know, innumerable benefits that trees offer. And Swami says, in other words, the seed destroys its own form or renounces its ego. And now the interesting thing, at the end Swami says, more seeds are both brought forth by the tree. And we see this, you know. So a person is there, like, as an individual, we are all we can remain limited to who we are, frightened by our own grandness. Right? And so we decide that, you know, we'll stick to, okay, you know, my individual vagaries of my mind, etc. But the moment we accept that invitation that Swami gives, you know, that can you step into your grander existence? And so the rarest of the rare individuals who do that, right? So the moment they become so big, now they are able to inspire, right? They are able to have many, many, many more people who then get inspired by their way of living. So I could look at one Ramakrishna Paramahamsa. You know, so he, under him, there were so many devotees. Each one of them were like magnificent in their own spiritual development. So Ramakrishna Paramahamsa begins in such a, like, such a humble village in the interior of West Bengal, and as a seed, right? And that seed breaks open and becomes a huge tree, and that tree itself gives rise to so many other seeds. So it's very beautiful, you know, the way. And of course, we are all talking about the same Atma in everyone. So the way it all ties together is like very beautiful.
You know, even as you're saying, I mean, quoting what Swami was telling here about the seed loses its shape and form, and it should be ready to do that. Maybe a little stretch of an explanation of what happened in 1950s when Swami was still in the Pathamandir. Apparently, a lot of these royal family people had come to Swami. Many of these princes and queens and all of them. You know, that was a time when India was becoming a republic. So there was this talk of all the other smaller sovereign states merging in this new republic, and the status of royalty will be removed from you and all of that. So all of them had come to Swami to seek Swami's grace so that that doesn't happen. They can retain their kingdoms, because we know the accession of freedom which was passed by the British was, we are leaving the subcontinent the way it was when we took over it. Apparently that's what they wrote in the document of freedom or whatever it is. So which means every kingdom which we took to become a part of the British India now goes back to its state of independence. So they can become a nation of their own. So all of these people had come to ask Swami that, Swami, please protect our, you know, countries. We should be able to rule it ourselves. So Swami said, don't worry, I bless you all. And Swami made a very cryptic statement. He said, not only will they be safe, in fact, each one of your kingdoms are going to grow multifold. So they were extremely happy, and they said, oh, we've got the blessing which we wanted. So they wanted to have a banquet to celebrate it, right? So they got all their royal cooks and butlers from there, along with all their silver cutlery and everything. And they set up a huge tent outside the Pathamandir so that they all could dine with Swami. Right? So they set up all the tables. So they will sit with Swami and have. And the shed beside was for the devotees, who all will sit down and eat. And they will also be served the same food. What Swami did, Swami apparently came early to that lunch meeting. And Swami called all his devotees, and Swami told them to sit on the chairs kept for the royalty.
Oh.
Right? So when these royalty walked in, they found that the seats were already taken. So then Swami very sweetly said, see, you are giving the treat. You know, you are, it's a party that you are throwing, literally. So you should be the host. You should be serving the people. Right? So Swami told them all to serve who were seated there.
Oh.
So a beautiful scene of the common man sitting and the royalty was serving them.
Right.
Okay. And to complete the whole scene, Swami stood there and started clapping his hands. And Swami said, times are changing, times are changing.
Oh.
And literally that's what happened. You know, eventually all of their kingdoms were taken into the Indian Republic. But the beauty was, some of these kings, you know, a case in point is, of course, the Rajmata of Jamnagar, who came much later. They had taken this thing so much to heart, the way Swami had wanted them to treat. They all became very important pillars in nation building later.
Beautiful.
Right? This concept what Swami is telling you know, if you have the ability to not fear losing your individuality and your limited size, the potential is so vast. Right? And, I mean, Swami literally led all of these people to take that thing which was coming in front of them.
Fantastic. The way, like, you know, here again we can see that drishti and srishti, like Swami changed the context, you know? So it's now no longer a painful thing for them to undergo that transition. It now becomes like an offering to the Lord.
Right.
All, it's definitely, even, you know, however well, you know, endowed you are with riches, etc., when they are taken away from you, it is a very, very painful feeling, right? But Swami has altered the context.
Mm.
Yeah, so gracious indeed. I was just thinking, like, it could well have been that Swami, as you were talking about, relating the incident, I felt that it could have well have ended with Swami not even appearing.
Mm.
Yeah, but he chose that moment to actually teach the royalty, you know,
right.
That. And at the beginning, he did not reveal what he well knew as to what would transpire. But to transition them in such a beautiful, painless manner, that is only the Lord can do it, you know. That's a very beautiful lesson for all of us, you know. Because it's very easy, you know, sitting where we are, for us to judge somebody of that stature, right? And there's a kind of that Schadenfreude, what they say, right? That that we would like to sometimes see them suffer, right? but Swami is so, you know, detached from all such human such emotions, right? And he treats everyone equally. Mm. For him, like, we don't. So for them also, he's able to stand as a guru rather than as anything else, rather than as a human being. That is a very beautiful incident.
In fact, if you look at this, especially since we mentioned Rajmata of Jamnagar, the things which Swami would tell that family, we've spoken to Indreshwar. See, it's not that they're completely bad or anything like that. It's not like, you know, they didn't want to let go of their wealth. And they wanted to remain royalty. Swami would say that with royalty, with that much amount of wealth and influence, so much of magnanimity comes along with it.
Yes.
And Swami would point out to that in their family.
Hmm.
Swami would say, no, you should protect this.
Yes.
No, let go values. Of this, but these values which come out of plenty, actually protect it, even hold on to it when you don't have.
Exactly.
And one of our students here, you know, when they went to Kurnool, they happened to meet some people who were in service of the Raja of Venkatgiri in the past. In the palace, they've been there when Swami would visit very often. And they were telling that, you know, that royal family of Venkatgiri, it must have been one more family which went through this transition with Swami there to guide them.
Right.
And he was saying that the Raja had given away all his lands to the villagers and the farmers who were working in his lands when this transition happened and Swami came into their lives. Especially after Swami came into their lives. He said he just gave away. All that they had was that one bungalow in which Swami used to visit. Because Swami used to visit, they kept that. Otherwise, everything they gave away. And he said the amount of loyalty which the people of that kingdom of Venkatagiri had, even now, if anybody from that lineage comes forward and says, give back our land, they will give it away to them.
Oh.
He said that is how much respect they had for him, and he had earned it through this way.
Right.
So you know how beautifully Swami says, transition has to happen. The small has to become big, but the core principles, the core nature should be fostered and, you know, taken forward.
Exactly, right. And then the next section, like, you know, it was a very, very nice thing you did, that at the beginning, you were brought to the fore that what did the discourse start with?
Right.
And you spoke about, like, how Swami says that Brahma Vidya, the Brahmanandam itself, is something that can be accessed even in our, you know, everyday life or this physical existence. But Swami puts a caveat there. He says through practice, you know, by practicing the teachings.
Right.
Right. Which at that time, I remember we discussed that Swami is very clearly saying that it is not that we aspire for divinity. You know, it's not that we say that we are humans and we got all these human qualities. And at some point of time, after so much, you know, sadhana, evolution, we will become divinity. Rather, Swami says that you got to understand the message of the Upanishads, which say that you are already divinity.
Right.
And then you got to act consistent with that. You know, that is the... And so, for Bhagwan, this practice is so very, very important. And so, that's why Swami says that it is to practice, you know, that we can gain this knowledge. But then again, there's a very, very subtle aspect to this, which then Swami brings out in the shloka which he recited. No? He says, Shreyo hi jnanam abhyasat. So, he says wisdom is better than practice. So, the idea is very simple. See, sometimes when we practice, we can have something called bad practice, right? Like you're picking up an instrument. Or even when we chant the Vedas, so our teachers used to be very, very careful about this one thing. They said when you are learning now, you should learn with the full knowledge of what are the Vedic rules of chanting.
Okay.
For example, the most important thing is intonation, right?
Intonation
in the Vedas is non-negotiable, and which is what has allowed it to be chanted in precisely the same form as it was eons back.
Awesome. Now,
what we chant today is how it was chanted like eons back.
Mm.
And the reason is that intonations cannot be messed with, right? So that is how, that is one aspect of it. So when you pick up a musical instrument, right?
Mm.
So the teachers, as far as possible, they try to perfect your practice. Otherwise you end up in what is, like, you could be practicing the same way of playing the violin, but then that is bad practice because you have not learned the right technique. Right?
Exactly.
So, hence Swami says that this practice should be tempered with a quest for wisdom. And at all points of time, we must keep inquiring, right? So, this is what we are practicing, that's fine. But then, like, is there any intellectual or a better understanding that clarity that I can gain, right? And when we gain that clarity, we might see that some of these practices, they recede, and we look at something new, right? So that is the kind of wisdom that Swami speaks about when he says Shreyo hi jnanam abhyasat. That wisdom is better than practice. It does not mean that we sit back and intellectualize, you know, rather than, because for Swami the most important thing was practice, not, you know, vacant intellectualization of a spiritual topic, right? And that's what he says. That,
right.
And every discourse is culminating with what are the practices you must engage in.
Right.
Right. And that's why wisdom is better than practice. And then Swami says meditation is better than wisdom. Right. That one must, you know, again, from where does wisdom come? So Swami is like kind of giving the hierarchy of first there is practice. And then there is meditation, right? It is in meditation that that wisdom actually dawns, you know. There's a quest for wisdom. It doesn't automatically come into our hands. And meditation is important, as the Upanishads are saying, that a lot of the last segment or two segments before, Swami was speaking about the voice of divinity within us. And we see that the noise that drowns out the voice of divinity comes from the senses feeding in all the time,
mind,
right? And that has to be quietened down so that this voice now begins to be heard by us, right? And so Swami says that meditation is therefore better than wisdom, in the sense that in the hierarchy it stands taller than wisdom as a practice, right? Because that's how the wisdom comes. But Swami ranks above all, and the Upanishad is also consistent about this, that it's through renouncing the fruits of action. So it is through renouncing the fruits of action that this is the thing that finally bestows infinite peace. Tyagat shantir anantaram. That is, so this is from, of course, the verse is from the Bhagavad Gita.
Bhagavad Gita, right. Very beautiful. I think many times I have gone through this thing, and I always have this problem, because Swami always comes to this in this way. He'll be talking about importance of practice, and he comes to this. And I think it's a very important point that you made, because practice can be of many types, and that practice which actually leads you to wisdom is what you need to do. And even when you're practicing, I think that is the direction that you have. Is the practice leading me to wisdom? If that is not happening, then there's seriously something wrong.
Exactly.
Because actually speaking, our life is filled with practice. We run after money, which is practice. We run after fame and respect. All of that is practice.
Exactly.
And it has come with practice. You know, when we were children, we were not like that.
Yes.
We have learned to live a life, acquired that thing that we should lead a life which someone looks at and, you know, has jealousy admires for. We have learned all of that through practice.
Right.
So Swami is saying that is not the practice. Your practice should be that which is being led by wisdom, right? And of course, as you were saying, that wisdom and meditation, that wisdom can even come from outside. It could come from a wise counsel from a person next to you, or from the book that you read. But the true wisdom, which Swami would always say, is that which comes from inside. And that comes only when the mind is silenced and you go into that state of meditation.
Yes.
And Swami would say it's not contemplation or concentration, it's meditation.
Yes.
And meditation is that state when you actually access the divinity within,
right,
in many ways. And I think from there again Swami goes to a little practical level, where he's saying that renouncing the fruits of action.
Yes.
That it's not like it's only a mental state. In the physical, again, it will be expressed as renunciation of action, and it will show as infinite peace in you. That's something which Swami would always say, that if your spirituality is not seen on your being as peace and love,
right,
then there's something seriously wrong with what you're doing.
Right.
You cannot be unhappy. Swami would say you cannot have a castor oil face and be spiritual at the same time.
Because renouncing fruits of action, so you must remember that it is Lord Krishna who is delivering this, right? And for Krishna, that was a lesson that he was delivering to Arjuna, who was, and we should look at Arjuna as many elders often advise us, that when you look at Arjuna, put yourself and look at how it applies to your life. And when we look at our lives, these are the kind of, every decision is fraught with our worrying about, how will it turn out, right? And which is why Lord Krishna gives us that it's the action that is most important, and not about the results.
Right.
It's being present fully in the action and doing it to the complete, and then renouncing it.
Right.
And not just that, again, for a spiritually inclined person, we look at so many practices, rituals, etc., which we undergo, and that has been the message of the Upanishads, that when you perform a spiritual practice of or a spiritual ritual of any sort, there are different ways of doing it. Like, so one is with, as the Upanishads say, you could do it with the intention of receiving some benefit in this physical world, and that you will. It says that having performed that, you will receive the benefits. And then there is the what they call the Chandrayana, where you perform the rituals in such a way that you say that, my afterlife should be better, and you will, so you will go to, they say, to a higher state, enjoy those benefits, and you come back.
As Swami said, like a parliamentarian for 5 years.
Exactly, yes.
But of course, our parliamentarians enjoy the benefits for a lifetime.
Yeah, you occupy that seat for, those 4 or 5 years allotted to you, and then you are back to being like a common man, at least in theory. And then when it comes to the highest practice, which the Upanishads speak about, is that when you perform the spiritual practice or a ritual, that it should be done only with the intent of, being one with divinity. So that is the Suryayana, like when you proceed towards the
ultimate
sun.
Right.
Yes.
Right. But of course, this thing about tyaga and giving up the fruits of the action, it's so easily said, but
Doing it,
we don't realize that, so much of our action depends on the response that we get from outside. As we always talk of this scenario, you go to a ticket counter, you go to a person in the bank or something like that. The moment the person on the other side of the counter is pleasing, it's very easy for you to be good. But will you be good if that person is nasty?
Exactly.
And there is a thought study they do, where they say that, let's say the teller in the bank has given you $100 bill extra by mistake. And if that teller is nasty, will you go back and tell the teller that, you've done this mistake? Or will you go back and tell if that person is pleasant? So 90% of the time, people will go back and tell if that person is pleasant. So which means our goodness is dependent on the people around.
Right.
And the whole idea is, can you be good? Can you do the right thing without worrying about what the other people say?
Yeah.
Like recently, there was one person who I was talking to, and this person was saying that when they were doing seva somewhere, they found that the way it was being done was the wrong way. So they suggested, it should be done like this. So the people who have been doing it for a long time got so upset with it, that how dare you come and correct us, right? So this person was so disturbed by it and literally thinking that, should I stop and go back home, Forgetting that, what are you? You're not doing that seva for the sake of the applause that you will get or the appreciation that you will get. But it does matter. We don't realize how much it matters to us unless we are put in a situation like this, and we review whether we should continue or not based on, the response of others.
As you were saying this, I just realized that, for a person who follows dharma, is very intent on following dharma, this sentence is most important, that it is the action and not the, you cannot be worried about the fruits or the results of the action, right? Because all you got to concentrate on is the right path or the right action, that is, that you follow the dictates of the conscience or the dharma or whatever Swami has requires us to do at that moment. And I was recalling a conversation I had with one of my classmates, my MBA classmates, about a couple of weeks back. So he's, you know, he's heading a company and it is going through a lot of turmoil at the moment. But I was just very, you know, I was telling him, like, as a student of Swami, like, don't you find it very difficult? Now, you are, that you are managing a company, don't you find it difficult to always follow Swami's principles?
Okay.
You know, because he is very close, I could take, I could be, you know, I had that rapport where I could take the chance of asking that, must be that you must be, you know, sacrificing somewhere, Swami's principles in order to get ahead or have your company. So he just thought about that for a moment and he said, I'll tell you something that happened just a few days back. So he said that he was, they were attempting to do a project, you know, in somewhere in one of the states, northern states of India. And this was a very big order. It meant a lot and it would have kept the company afloat. You know, they had not been paying salaries for a while, right? Okay. And this would have meant a lot. So they go there and while everything, the negotiations, everything is about complete, that's when a senior bureaucrat comes and says that I need a big cut. You know, in order for this to be passed now by the ministers, I need a big cut from this. And, you know, he just said that, you know, my principles do not allow for me to do this. I would like the project to be accepted on the merit of the project and not because I paid you anything. And he and the bureaucrat, he left in a huff. And as he said this, I asked him, like, at that moment, weren't you scared that, you know, now my company will be ruined? It's his own, you know. My company will get ruined because of this one decision. And it is a decision that influences, like,
so many
people. You can always justify saying that my doing this one small, you know, act of against dharma, it is still benefiting so many people, right? As some people say that, my family will get, you know, they will benefit. Let me be the person villain in this. But they get benefited and hence it kind of rationalizes this. And he said that I, at that moment, for me, it was only pleasing Swami that was important. His message always used to ring, you know, do the right thing. And I couldn't contravene him of all things. So I said, no, that's it. No matter what happens. So that is where, you know, that tyage naike amrita, you have to renounce. And you have no idea how it will pan out. But then dharma is what you have to hold on to. And he says a few days prior, they were called by that state government and said that you have won the project. And of course, that particular bureaucrat, he insisted that my classmate, he should not attend that meeting. He should send a junior because he could not face him. But, you know, he says that whatever it is, no matter how it would have turned out, this is how I acted. But I'm very grateful to Bhagwan that, you know, he has proved again that dharma rakshati rakshita. Right. That, you know, when I stick to dharma, dharma will find a way of protecting me.
Absolutely, you know. Happy endings always good. But the thing is, even when there are no happy endings,
exactly,
as Swami said, you just hold on till, if there is no happy ending, then it's not an ending at all.
Exactly.
With Swami. But from what you said, it all comes from what Swami said in that first clip which we played. Love God.
Yes.
Believe that God loves you.
Yes.
And even that is not enough. You should do everything as an act of pleasing the Lord and, you know, finally have that complete reliance on the Lord's grace. I mean, I think that was a perfect example for all of that. So we'll have to conclude with that. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. Do join us again next week for the continuation of this discourse. We have a couple of clips more to go. I think three more clips before we conclude this discourse. I thank Hari on behalf of all of you for joining us, and we most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet. A short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of the day, the Vahini Satsang. But we'll join you again next week at 7:30 p.m. Jai Sainam.